Thank you for listening to the Following Films podcast, a movie podcast that takes you on a weekly journey into the world of cinema and the minds of the talented individuals who shape it. I'm your host, Chris Maynard, and today we have two interviews on the episode. First up, we have Shot in the Arm executive producer Neil deGrasse Tyson and director Scott Hamilton Kennedy. Shot in the Arm is a critically renowned documentary that examines vaccine hesitancy and the impact it has on public health. After the break, I'm joined by Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Christy Jacobson to discuss her film No Accident. The film examines the aftermath of the deadly Charlottesville, Virginia Unite the Right white nationalist rally in 2017. It follows a lawsuit that aimed to hold the aggressors accountable. The lawsuit alleged that the event was not an isolated, spontaneous gathering, but rather a well-planned, coordinated conspiracy designed to incite racially motivated violence and to advance an anti-Semitic race war agenda. What follows is a courtroom drama that provides insight to an astonishing moment in history. But before we dive into the interviews, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Bookmans. Bookmans is your go-to independent bookstore, where you can find an extensive selection of books, movies, music, and so much more. They truly believe in the power of storytelling and the magic of the cinematic arts. So if you're looking to expand your film, music, or book collection, be sure to visit your nearest Bookmans. There's always something truly wonderful to discover. Have you followed the Following Films podcast on Spotify? If you have, well, thank you. If you haven't, head on over to Spotify. Search for Following Films and give us a follow. And as an extra incentive this week, the fine folks over at Universal have given us a couple digital codes for My Big Fat Greek Wedding 3. To be entered to win a code, all you need to do is follow the Following Films podcast on Spotify and send me a screenshot. You can send the screenshot to Chris at Following Films or DM me on Twitter. My handle is at Following Films. Two winners will be chosen at random next week. If you'd like to support the show by becoming a paid subscriber, you can go to podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/followingfilms/support. And if for some reason you didn't catch that, you can find the link in the show notes. Shot in the Arm will be in theaters on November 3rd, and No Accident is currently streaming on Max. I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks. Hey guys, how are you today?
Hello.
Good to see
you. Floating in space.
Floating in space.
Thank you both so much for taking the time to do this today. I really do appreciate it. This is
thanks for your interest.
Well, of course. Yeah. It's a necessary thing that this film is here right now. I was deeply interested in this movie just because it touches a lot of things that are very personal to me. I think this is personal for everybody at this point. There's nobody this doesn't impact. But the thing that I think this film does so amazingly well is it doesn't get on the soapbox the way I would and point fingers and yell at folks, which is what my temptation is to do. And it creates, I think, an olive branch between two people or two sides of an issue that does not, we don't need to be at arms with one another.
And that's the end of our interview. You said everything.
Thank you.
Let's go have a beer.
Keep going. Thank you so much for putting it that way.
I think we would fumble over sentences for the next 10 minutes and not be able to say it that succinctly.
Yeah.
But I can say, as a scientist, educator, obviously, I'm not a medical professional, but I have an awareness and a sensitivity to communicating science, to celebrating the methods and tools of science, recognizing how they uniquely, it turns out, uniquely take us from where we are to objective truths manifested within nature. And I bring some of that, the nuances of that, those details to Scott's storytelling, but it's Scott's empathy that you're reacting to, where its power is not how loudly does it stand on the mountaintop and declare truths, but how it moves through the modes of uncertainty and doubt that exist in people who were taken in by highly charismatic leaders of an anti-scientific movement. So, yeah, you said it all.
I appreciate it. Empathy, distinguishing and having empathy for parents who were led astray, and distinguishing between them and people who are purposely fomenting disinformation for their own benefit, selling a product, selling their ego, selling their show. We wanted to work very hard to distinguish between those two things. So thank you. I'm so glad that that rang true for you.
Well, this is, I have a 7-year-old son who's on the spectrum. And so I understand this journey that a lot of these people have gone through. And though when I was watching the film last night, it was something that my wife actually asked me to close the door because she was in the bedroom. And when she hears certain opinions voiced, I can't take it. I can't listen to it. Wow. Because it hurts too much. But to see this explored in this way is really helpful for somebody like me. Because I understand going through this and looking for a reason why, and looking for an explanation and looking for an answer, because that's something innate in humans. We need explanations to things. Absolutely. And
we also want to blame. Blame is a big part of our satisfaction in our state of mind. So, yeah.
And it's just, I think that your film does an amazing job at helping me reconnect with who I was 5 years ago at that moment, and understanding that there was divergence I could have taken very easily. Yeah. And said, okay, I need something I can hang my hat on right now, because this is very difficult for me to get my head around. And so I get it. And I appreciate this. I think that this is, you would think a film like this could be, it has a point of view for sure, but the point of view is on fact. That's it. This is not a political film. This is not something, it's about a bunch of snake oil salesmen is really where the finger pointing is here that you're pointing to. And I genuinely appreciate that. There's several arcs that you show throughout this film that I think you obviously couldn't have figured out ahead of time. And so to see those is really impressive.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Scott, you had to pivot multiple times, not pivot, but you had to pause and bring in new directions that society was going and still fold it into a coherent story. So I don't envy that challenge. I mean, you're the filmmaker here. I just run around behind you and help you tell the message. But
it is the double edge. It is the double edged joy of making a documentary, that my simple definition of a documentary is the adaptation of the truth, right? That it is my adaptation, as you said, a point of view. I work very carefully to watch that point of view, but it is my team's adaptation of what's really going on. But I underline truth, truth, truth. While there will be people out there that say, I got things wrong, that's going to be a slur, not an argument. So if somebody wants to present something that we didn't get wrong, we worked very, very hard to have it scientifically valid. But then also to have the power, the joy of being a storyteller is that it is my adaptation. We do get to decide who we're following, how much time we spend with them, what music we use, all those things in the editing, and try to put that into an order that works in the way that the magic of storytelling works and still maintains the truth. So yeah, it's hard work. Well, what's the old adage, Neil? Everybody, if it wasn't hard, everybody would be doing it.
Yeah. So,
yeah. No,
there's not much in the world worth achieving that wasn't hard to begin with.
That's it. Mm. That's it.
Yeah. Right.
And the way, as Neil was touching on, where you started this was already something that needed to be addressed with the anti-vaccine movement that had started, really, you know, with this one, God, I will not use the word I want to describe Mr. Wakefield right now, but the fucking asshole. To me, four of the most dangerous words that exist right now are do your own research. Oh, the way that we've been able to progress as a society is defaulting to the knowledge of others who have specialized and trained for years of their lives. And we move forward because we all come together as a collective and say, you spent your life working on this. I will trust your opinion on it. We will move forward together because the consensus as a team is this. We're going, and that's beyond just science. That's agriculture is science, but it's all these different elements that just, it's not a trust is so important there.
By the way, there's even a subtle element of that often gets overlooked. So, yes, the person who does 2 hours of search on Google and they hit that awareness against that of experts who spent their life doing it. This is going on all the time. you know, do your own research thing. That's right. However, there's still the difference between the lone scientist declares that they have an answer and they're correct, even if it conflicts with the mainstream science. And people say, well, I am listening to an expert who spent their whole life doing it. So there's another gate there, which is the scientist reporting their own work or the consensus of multiple scientific experiments and laboratory tests? And a scientific truth, objective, a scientific result does not achieve objective truth status just because one person got that result. It needs to be verified multiply by other scientists. Only then is it the case. So when Fauci speaks, yes, he's an expert, but he's communicating consensus. And the word consensus is unfortunate because if you look it up, it says opinion. Whereas, and we don't have a word, a good word to swap into there, a consensus of scientific research is not the weight of opinion, it's the weight of scientific observations and experiment. And that's the difference.
It's with all of the information, all the research that we have right now.
Correct.
This is where we understand the world to be right now.
And there are scientists who can deliver that. Yeah. And there's scientists who say, they're all wrong and I'm right, believe me.
Yes.
And so I want to distinguish the two-hour Google search person and the person who finds a cherry-picked scientist who says what they want to hear versus any scientist or any other platform that is communicating the scientific consensus. And for some reason in there, the word consensus ended up getting a bad name.
They're using it, Neil. They're using it to try and make it seem, Robert Kennedy Jr. does all the time. He tries to flip it and say, well, consensus is the enemy of science.
Right.
Right. And so I've come to use the term, we've done this together, Neil, that some of these people are not just corrupt, they're corrosive. Mm. So they're using the term you brought up, Chris, which is awful, that do your own research, right? It sounds so innocent. It sounds so empowering, right? They're brilliant at doing these things, right? They are absolutely brilliant communicators. It sounds so empowering, but in the end, they are corroding our trust in expertise. And that in the end benefits them because they're saying, don't trust them, trust us, which leads me to saying, well, you really want us to trust you? Let's buy you an island and you guys all get to start over again. Let's see how that works out. That's my new reality TV show. It's going to be called Schlock Island.
No. Well, there's the thing that RFK, I think the bookend to the other, if you have just this library of shit that's ruining our world right now, on one end, you have the do your own research and the other end that just encapsulates everything is I'm just asking questions. Yep. It's like those eight words right there. It's just you're asking questions in a context with the end result of sowing doubt. And that's it. And it's just to what is your gain that you're getting out of this? And, you know, look behind the thin veil to see what's motivating them. Why are they doing
this? Can
we
bring you on our future interviews?
Yeah, you're so good. Really good. Wait, Chris, I'm going to give you one. Maybe you've heard it, but you're going to really like it. Is Jonathan Haidt, he introduced me to it. I'm not sure if he coined it. A slur is not an argument.
Oh,
right? So that's a counter.
I like that.
That's a counter to the things that they're putting on the table. So when they slur, because even do your own research is in its own way is a slur. It's like, well, do your research. How are you going to, what results are you going to get? So yeah, we have to remind people the difference between a slur and an argument. And we're living through a time where people think, oh, the slur is success, right? The slur is me winning a debate because I slurred you in a more effective way than you tried to slur me, which is never supposed to be part of it. Come to me with an argument. If somebody has something that they want to point out within this film that they have evidence to say we got wrong, we are all ears. But just don't come to me with a slur and say you're a shill or whatever thing they're going to throw at us. So.
Well, that's the scientific consensus. That's the mindset behind that. That's why you had, at one point in time, the doubter, the one person who stood out and said, you know, maybe we should be washing our hands before we have surgery. And everyone else said, you're crazy. This doesn't make sense. And so you take that little anecdote and say, well, then that's why we can doubt everything. But the scientific community said, well, what are you talking about? And then
looked into it, researched it, started looking behind it, and actually validated this outlier's claims. And that's how I think being a scientist is an incredibly humble life's pursuit, because you're the thing that you're looking for is to be wrong. You're looking for, you're in search of truth, and you find that by really not being married completely to ideas, that you understand that this is just this moment in time, at least to me from the outside as a knuckle dragon layman. That's how I view it.
And embracing that, Chris, being comfortable in that place, right? Neil has a beautiful saying that don't be afraid of what is true, right? It's like, you're just comfortable in the fact that this is going, science is messy. People like to say democracy is messy. There's some overlap between those two institutions. And the people that don't want to be comfortable in that are going to use that discomfort to say, look, you can't trust them. So it's a strange time that we are living through. And all we can do is continue to communicate and be humble and try and reach people and connect with them to see that we're more often alike than we are different.
Yes.
And get back to, like, what I love to ask, what do you trust in? Because we're trusting in it all the time. We're trusting in the technology to make this interview work. And so are all these other people, right? You see Rand Paul in the movie. Why are we listening to why do we think a bunch of experts are supposed to tell us what to do? And then he's going to go get in his car and he's going to eat food and he's going to get on a plane, all these things. And that there are thousands of studies and scientists and checks and balances of systems in place to make those things work. Let's point out and ask, why are you stopping? Where's the disconnect? Why are you stopping there? And those systems are working and coming over here. And the answer is, don't tell me what I get to believe is true.
It's a disheartening state that we're in right now. But you asked the question, what do you believe in? I actually still have faith in humanity.
Yes.
People that have wildly different points of view on so many different things. In the end, I think, you know, the thing for me, I know that somebody who's trying to do best by their children, we have very similar goals in mind. We've just been led down different paths, really. And I think that reaching out to one another and connecting with our empathy, that's one of the greatest risks that we have right now, is the dehumanization of one another. And that's politics, that's science, that's everything that we have right now. The downside to technology, I get to talk to two of you. That's one of the upsides right now because of technology, the way it exists. But I think there's a lack of humanity that we see in one another right now. But I think we're getting better at it, though. It feels like when I see my kids and when I go visit my 7-year-old in class and I think of the way kids were treated when I was younger, that there's hope there for sure.
Progress. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's more people that want to wake up in the morning and do what you just described, Chris, than don't. That's it. That's a glass half full, more than half full for me. So
do you believe that the people that are pushing the divisiveness amongst us, that they see what they're doing and they know the game? Or do you think they genuinely believe in what they're saying?
Oh, it's always, we get that
question. Scott and I differ on this.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think they actually believe what they're saying. Rather than, I think you have to put people's lives at risk that way. You have to really believe that you're saving them. And so this is the disconnect between an objective reality and... And I think that also, as Scott makes very clear in the film, in the storytelling, that these people are heroes to a community, to a demographic. And when you have a hero, it's kind of hard to, when you are the hero, it's hard to just walk away from that. Mm-hmm. Or to say, I've been wrong all these years. Or I did some extra research. I spoke with some scientists and I changed my mind. It's hard to imagine them saying that, given how deeply embedded they are. So it is possible to just lead a life in a delusional belief. And I think they do. Well, let me say it differently. If that's not true, then they're fundamentally evil. And yeah. I can't embrace that possibility. It's not within me to think that way about them.
It's funny because you said that we there's parts of us that don't agree on this, Neil. There's parts of this that we don't agree on, Neil. But then you came back, you kind of said both of them at the same time, that they have to believe in it But even if they are presented with the truth, they're going to continue to believe in it because of the audience capture and the failure of ego and all those things. But let's go to the glass half full side and look at the Prime Minister of Samoa, who made a terrible decision to stop all vaccines because he was scared. They had a tragedy around two deaths from babies from a mistake around a measles vaccine. He stopped all vaccines because he had some fear around autism and vaccines. And then they had a terrible measles outbreak and he changed his mind. And he said, no, I'm going to get the vaccine on television. And they did stop this measles outbreak. So we have the potential to do it. The question is, I mean, I've said this my whole life. I'm sure we probably all had friends, the ones that have bullshit detectors in their lives and the ones that don't. And I'm so grateful. Neil has become a mentor of bullshit detecting in my life. My wife is one of them.
Bologna sandwich detecting. When you're in mixed company, it's bologna sandwich.
Thank you. Bologna sandwich.
Yes, detector.
We're on the interweb, so we get to say it. But you understand, we all had friends that don't have those human checks and balances in their lives of like, hey, you're drifting a little bit here, right? You're drifting here. Come on back. We know you want to come back to this. Come on back to us. Let's talk about this. And that's where it's like, we're all our brother's keepers in that way, right? That I love, I'll say it to your viewers, that if you see me drifting in a next film or in an interview, and I could have had it factually right, but I could have my tone better, talk to me. Let's try and make each other better and not be, you know, caught up and fearful of wanting to hear criticism that in the end could be helpful.
Letting go of your ego is one of the most important things that you can do to be a successful human, any pursuit you have. You can take criticism, bring it in, own that criticism, and then move forward with your life. And if like you were saying, if it's a slur, let go of that. But if there's something in there that is something helpful for you, then take that on. If somebody tells me that I'm a pompous asshole, it's a slur, but maybe there's something in there in the way I'm presenting my argument that I need to think about so that I get better at communicating.
Yes.
I'm so thankful though that there are people communicating this point of view right now, because it's something that blame that you were talking about, Neil, and the idea of, you know, Scott, you're just saying the disconnect that we have and, you know, these people, are they evil? Are they good? That kind of thing. I think we kind of have to disconnect from that part of it and just really just try to inform as much as we can. And that's the only weapon we have,
again,
really.
And connect again. And one of the things we've seen was so beautiful about the film experience, and that now that we get to go back into movie theaters and we've seen it with the film, is that communal experience, right? And storytelling is one of the most, if not the most powerful tool we have to help us make the best decisions and get past disagreements. And we've seen it with this film where we've screened it and had a variety of people in the audience. And that doesn't mean at the end of it, everybody's gonna have a kumbaya moment and say, we all agree on everything and let's go dancing out in the aisles. We can still disagree, but maybe we talk to each other more decently. Or we see where we might disagree on those issues, but we agree on the social contract. We agree on decency. And it's through the power of storytelling and that that community experience of seeing a film together that it's one of the things that attracted me to becoming a storyteller, a filmmaker. So
it's not unlike the way vaccines work themselves.
Ooh.
If you think about it, because the change is often glacial. It's something that's very small and it's hard to detect that moment that it happened, you know, where you're saying people are going off the rails. You know, you don't really see it till it fully forms and presents itself, you know, where you have this person you've known for years, then all of a sudden they have a lot of ideas you didn't know that they were harboring for a while. They've been building things up, and, you know, that I think that that's how it works. It's invisible. It's in the background. And so this can be one of those little steps in there that you've made with this, that you can hopefully, because I think it's made in a way that either side of this idea, this argument, could watch this and come out with some ways to improve themselves. And whether or not they'll recognize it and chase it back to this exact moment, I think it's there, and you're laying some seeds, and we need those.
Appreciate you.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Scott. Thank you, Neil. It's really great to meet both of you. I really appreciate it. This was a pleasure.
Thanks for your interest and your insights. Like I said, We'll take you on the road.
That's right.
I am there in a heartbeat. Where are you
based?
In Tucson, Arizona.
My in-laws just moved from there. Okay, we're just there.
So. Really?
Oh. They retired, so they moved to an assisted living place. But yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Beautiful, beautiful.
You guys have the best dark sky in the country.
I was gonna say that we have a ton of observatories out here, and there's just some mountains. Kitt Peak is amazing.
The municipal legislation that other cities copy for the model of how to not create light pollution, yet still have a population that occupies a major city. So
it's pretty wonderful when I walk out in my neighborhood at night. There's not a single street light in my neighborhood, and you can just see the sky. It's pretty wonderful, especially this time of year when I can actually go out with a Google Sky in my pocket and, you know, talk to my son about what we're looking at. And
in my day, we had to remember what was in the sky.
That's right. That's right. Technology. I'm with you, Chris.
You youngins, look what you all have.
I'll take the technology.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, once you get beyond some dippers, I really kind of lose what I'm looking at. So I need the assist. But thank you both. I really do appreciate it, guys.
Yeah, I hope we can meet down the road, Chris. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. I hope so, too.
Today's episode of the Following Films podcast is brought to you by Bookmans. So the last time I went into Bookmans, I went straight over to the movie section, as I often do. And I was so excited because one of my favorite things that happens when I go in there, I'm looking for a movie and I don't know exactly what I want to see, something I've been meaning to see, and there's a blind spot. And when I saw East of Eden, I was super excited because it's a movie I've been wanting to see for years, but for whatever reason, I've just never gotten around to it. So the film adaptation of John Steinbeck's East of Eden, it's a powerful cinematic achievement. I know I'm not the first person to say this, but it absolutely does justice to the novel's what can only be described as profound themes and the complex characters. It's directed by Kazan and features outstanding performances from the whole cast, but mainly here by James Dean as Cal Trask. The film captures the essence of the book while adding its own visual and emotional dimension. The cinematography, which looks absolutely incredible in 4K, captures the rugged beauty of the California landscape. So it sets the stage for this intense family drama that unfolds throughout the film. And the screenplay manages to condense this complex novel that is East of Eden without feeling truncated. It makes this really intricate plot, takes that and then just condenses it down and really only gets the essential elements of it. And all the themes are still intact with love, jealousy, and the struggle between good and evil. That's all there. And it doesn't feel like a lesser than, it feels like a complement to. If you've read East of Eden and haven't seen the film, definitely catch up on it. Highly recommend it. If you've only seen the film and haven't read the book, definitely check out the book as well. It's worth your time. But in the movie, James Dean's portrayal of the troubled Cal, it's nothing short of iconic. It showcases his raw talent and charisma. The supporting cast is also incredible, especially Julie Harris, I think, does an equally compelling job here with just an outstanding performance. And there's a depth and authenticity to these characters that wasn't very common for this time. So it's something pretty remarkable here. East of Eden, it's absolutely a classic that continues to resonate to this day, still holds up. I think that's mainly because of its exploration of human nature and the complexity of family dynamics. It's a timeless masterpiece that deserves a place in the annals of cinematic history. I think it's there. It just took me a long time to catch up with it. This is a must watch for anyone who appreciates powerful storytelling and exceptional performances. So remember, next time you go to Bookmans, they have your cool covered. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Hey, Christy, how are you today?
Hi, I'm pretty good. How are you?
Good. Well, it's good to see you. I wish that it wasn't under the circumstances of talking about a film like this that is unfortunately salient and something that, despite being 6 years ago, feels like this happened yesterday. And I just seeing everything that's going on this weekend, it's just, my God, it's something that this film just speaks to much larger truths about our society and the whole globe at this point. So thank you for making a film like this and talking about it.
Thank you for bringing me here to talk about it. It's sometimes hard for me to talk about any of the films that I make. And this one feels especially challenging. So yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, it's one of those things where it's, I think you're exactly right, that a subject matter like this, the idea of an audience member taking 90 minutes out of their life to spend their time in this world for a little bit, it can feel uncomfortable and something that you don't always want to do, but something that we know that we need to do. We need to spend time in this headspace just to be aware of the world around us. You can't put up the blinders, because I think that's a lot of what has happened, is that we've ignored problems for too long and they've just really been bubbling under the surface to the point now that they've just fully erupted throughout the world. And there's a good thing about having the light shine on these issues so that we can hopefully address them. So if there is a positive, I'm hoping that's it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hopeful with this film, and this is true of any film that I put my, you know, essentially blood, sweat, and tears into. You know, I hope that it can impact on one person. You know, maybe they see the world a little bit differently. Maybe they feel they can do a little bit more to make the place in which they live, whether that's their home, their community, their city, state, country, world, you know, more of a place where we can all live freely and free from oppression and fear of violence. I think also, like, one of the things, the great kind of joys of filmmaking, even when you're tackling subjects like this, is like kind of figuring out what's the cinematic approach going to be. And, you know, we tried, and I think we succeeded in making a legal thriller, you know, people like watching legal thrillers. And so hopefully you want to come watch this for those reasons. And something I really love to talk about, and since I know your, you know, film is something that we're here to talk about, is one of our sort of like our cinematic North Star in making this film was Michael Clayton.
Of course.
Film. And it made just everything we kind of did, like even when we got locked down, it was like we just saw everything as like an opportunity to elevate what we were doing cinematically and artistically, because we knew that just like, you know, creating just a document of what happened would be important, but making a film that people, you know, engage with and are moved by, hopefully accomplishes a greater goal than just that.
Well, this isn't a film that, despite the subject matter, that feels ever like it's on a soapbox. I never felt like the movie was preaching to me in that sense. It's all obvious. So I don't insult the audience by doing that. I think that you just give the facts of the case here and you present them in a way, like you are saying, like Michael Clayton. I was at a press screening last night for The Burial, which is the Jamie Foxx, Tommy Lee Jones thing. And I was just struck by how structurally, how similar these are with the payoff and the idea of using civil litigation to make important social changes and how that can happen. And it's just something that you're really telling a very similar story here to different ends and different impacts, but there are moments that are lighthearted in your film. There's actually more comedy than I ever would have thought. There's several moments that are very funny, as well as things that are, you know, heartwarming and touching. And just there's things about this, the sincerity of some of these people and how they were able, they're so inspiring. You don't feel like you've been drugged through the mud after leaving a film like this. I feel like you leave this film feeling better about the world and possibly re-engaged with it.
Yeah, no, I'm so happy to hear that, as you can imagine. And I think the journey of making it also was, you know, there was a real balance of, you know, there is really dark, hateful things that are being said, yeah, and that we're exposing ourselves to in the making of the film that can, you know, themselves take a toll. But then there are these incredible humans, you know, people people who were living their lives on August 10th and 11th and, you know, whose lives were changed forever on August 11th and 12th. But that's like ultimately what I connect with is these are people who, you know, not only stood up then, like they weren't silent then on those 2 days, August 11 and 12, right? Then they put themselves as named plaintiffs on this lawsuit, putting themselves and their families in at risk. And then they did it again to testify at trial 4 years later. And then now here they are part of this documentary. So that's kind of, you know, the what I get from this. And each of those individual plaintiffs, I am so moved by their stories, you know, like, and their courage, and there's so much more, and they're complex human beings, of course. But I love just being able to connect with people about our shared humanity, or like on the level of our shared humanity.
Well, I think it's very easy to see yourself in all of the plaintiffs here. When you look at this and you see all these people that you could easily have been, for most of us, I think you will not see the separation between you and these people that it's, yeah, I could have, should have been in that moment when, if this was my backyard in my town, if that was here in Tucson, would I have gone down to anti-protestants? Yeah, of course. That's the right thing to do in that moment. How would I have reacted in that moment? I think most of us are like that, because most of us are just normal, average people. And that's what's so extraordinary about these people, that they absolutely were just average people doing an extraordinary thing.
Yeah. It's funny, like every time I'm trying to like write a little blurb or what am I going to say, I say something and I write like extraordinary people, and then I delete extraordinary, not because they aren't, but I don't want to, you know, set them apart from everybody else in that way. And I don't think they want that. I can't speak for them, but yeah.
Well, it's that thing when you have, oh, this was the person that was top of their class at Harvard that did this amazing thing. And you automatically just say, okay, well, they were of a different breed than I am. They were a different person. And when you see stories like this, where you can project yourself into that position and say, okay, this is, I think it resonates much deeper with that. Yeah. Not that people that were top of their class at Harvard can't have being incredibly inspirational, but there's something, the Mother Teresa types and those people, you just look at them and you say, that's not me. I can't do that. I'm far too flawed. But when you see people that are just utterly steeped in humanity doing things like this, it's just inspiring.
Totally. And then you also see these lawyers, right? Yeah. Like lawyering at the highest level. To like have had for me and my team to have like had the front row access we had to that process was really profound. And again, then in the telling, you know, in the hundreds of hours of footage that we had between the depositions and the evidence, and then the verite footage, our editor Chris Hurd, you know, really just had a lot in her hands, you know, to weave together. But that piece of it was really, I think, special, to get to kind of witness these extremely, I would say, talented lawyers doing what they do best.
Just because you touched on it, can you talk a little bit about the editing process in this? Because editing is always a bit of alchemy to me, where I'm a horrible editor. I can tell a story, but editing is just something that's a gift from, you have something special if you can do that. If you can do documentary editing, though, with the amount of footage and creating a narrative that's this concise and this tight from your 97 minutes, something like that, this film. Yeah. And so you're coming down from, like you said, hundreds of hours of, you have deposition, you have a cell phone camera video, you have the interviews that you're doing, all those things, and then pulling that all together for this little moment that you're pulling out. And then how you're piecing all these little narratives together throughout it. It's just something that's really impressive.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's like our editor, like, she was exceptional in that. That we had multiple plaintiffs, multiple lawyers, multiple defendants that included groups and individuals. And then like a couple different timelines or like, you know, moments in time, because so much time passed while we were making the film. And then a trial that took place without our cameras being allowed in the courtroom. So that you feel like that we've created this kind of legal thriller is really a testament to Chris's kind of strength in figuring out, and you know, we did this together, the narrative structure that would bring you along, give you enough information as you needed it, but again, not too much. And also the editing begins in the field in documentaries, or at least in my documentaries, in terms of, you know, the Michael Clayton of it all. Like we had this vision, and Nosheen Dadaboy, our DP, our cinematographer, really looked at every situation with an eye towards how is this going to see the scene going to play out. You know, we're not flies on the wall, as some people say, right? Like we are hoping to be present in the space and capture what's unfolding, but we're also bringing some of our artistry to the space. And I really loved knowing that. And, you know, we had our lists on the wall when we were in Charlottesville of scenes and all the kinds of things we wanted to try and capture so we could deliver to our edit room some of the goods that we needed to make the film. And then Chris really kind of wove it together. And I think what you said, though, was so important is we talked a lot about the humanity being really essential, the humor, the lightness. You know, this is not just a boom, boom, boom. You know, these are real people who, you know, have to use humor sometimes or eat candy to get through a hard night. That was something that I was really grateful we were all lined up on. We were all synced up on.
Well, it's something that when I see a film, read an article, and it's trying to represent a specific moment in time and there's no humor in it, it just doesn't feel real to me. That doesn't feel honest. You know, the example that I always go to, I've never been to a funeral for someone that I love that we didn't laugh at some point in time during that day. It's a part of our processing. It's how we deal with things that are really uncomfortable and hard. We make fun of it. We make light of it. It's the only way. It's how we really express how human we are, I think.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I can tell you that there was a lot of laughter in the late nights, early mornings, you know, during the year long edit. And, you know, someone from the outside looking in is like, what? Why are these people laughing? But if you take it all so seriously, right? Like it is really serious.
Of course.
But you've gotta put some love and joy and humor into it in order for people to connect with it.
So when you're taking on this, did you start this in 2017?
So I came on board, the project started shortly after the lawsuit was filed.
Okay.
And our executive producer, Dylan McGee, had heard about it through Robbie and was like, we need to make a film. And one of our producers, Ali Moss, was on it right away. And I joined in 2018.
Okay.
You know, it's been a long, long journey. Yeah.
5 years deep at this point. And that's pretty typical from what I've seen in documentary films. That's the turnaround on these things. Sometimes there's multiple that are going at the same time, but a lot of times it's just it is a deep, deep commitment to make a documentary film. When you're jumping on board this, do you have time to look at this and say, okay, this is going to be the next 4, 5, 6 years of my life in this story? Am I okay with doing that? And what does that feel like from that commitment moment to today when you're kind of releasing it into the world?
So somehow, despite the fact that every feature documentary I have made has taken more than 3 years, close to five, every single time I feel that like pull, that like there's just this thing that happens and I can't let go. I can't stop thinking about it. But I also tell myself this time it's going to be different. this is going to be like one of those ones that's easy to make that like I see other people making. but once it's got like its claws in me, once I think that it's going to make a difference and I'm the right person, I've assembled the right team, then, you know, the challenges, and on this film, there are, you know, on any film, there are many. And on this one, they just like kept coming at us. But they just seem like a challenge that we must face and overcome and keep going. Yeah. Well, so I don't know what my problem is. I anticipate it will happen again. But yeah.
Do you have the next one lined up that you're thinking about doing and committing yourself to, or are you going to give yourself a little bit of time?
So I don't, I'm really fortunate in that I work on a lot of like shorter form projects when I'm right. in on a long form project, because it just takes up so much of my kind of, you know, emotional space and creative space. So then there's like some room left and I get to do some really cool things. Like I directed an episode of Dogs on Netflix. I have an upcoming episode of a series that will be on National Geographic, and a project I'm doing about women artists who resist. And I'm really excited about those projects. The next like mountain that I'm going to climb, I don't think I've like set foot on it yet. Or if I have, I don't know it yet.
Mm. It could be something that's unfolding right now that you just haven't gotten the call for. Unfortunately, films like this they're so important and they're so necessary right now. And congratulations on managing to tell a very important story that doesn't feel like homework. This is something that goes down very easily, something that I highly recommend people check out, because it's not just we need the shot in the arm to be reminded of this, because this isn't going away. This feels like in my mind when I just, if I see a tiki torch, even to this day, or even a Dodge Challenger, like it's one of the first thoughts that pop in my head. And I don't think that's going to go away for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for, you know, connecting with the film on in so many different levels. That's the one. Yay.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm definitely looking forward to whatever's coming down the pike next. And maybe you have just like a light romantic comedy in your future.
I've totally tried. It's like, my family is like, really? This is how you followed up your last film? But yeah.
I get it. But thank you for doing the work. It's important. So
thank you.
I appreciate it. Awesome. Okay. It was nice to meet you.
You too.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Time enough to figure you out. Time enough to write this down. Wish me luck, give me hope.
voice crack.
Let's do the time warp again! It's just a joke to run!